Tonight, our main speaker is Mike.
My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Full Measure Speaker Group in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And my sobriety date is October 4th, 1992. And my family's pretty delighted about that day, as am I. I want to welcome all of the people that stood up that are relatively new. Man, I had no idea what kind of life that Alcoholics Anonymous would lead me to here when I got here. And, you know, at the beginning of how it works, they talk about how rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And if you don't hear anything else I say here tonight, you know, I have never seen anybody fail who has thoroughly followed the path of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have yet to see it. When I talk about the path, what I'm talking about is getting with a sponsor that was talked about earlier, following the clear-cut instructions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that show us how to recover from alcoholism, have a couple commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, and give this thing away as it was freely given to you. I have yet to see anybody relapse that has done those things. And that's not based on a 6 months window of observation. That's a little over a couple decades of being on what, you know, I guess maybe the front lines of AA. It probably looks a different in Iowa than it does in New York, but maybe not. I have heard more horns and seen more crazy drivers in the last 24 hours than I've seen in the last 5 years. I grew up on a working family farm and by good people, and my grandparents had a farm up the road, and I would sit with my grandma and my granddad out on that little swing out on their lawn, and once in a while, a car would drive by, you know. And there were many evenings where nobody would drive by. And the cars that did drive by, they would always honk and wave, and Granddad always knew who it was. You know, that kind of impressed me. But I love those people. And that was my dad's parents, and my mom's parents lived, they were farmers too, and they lived about 12 miles north of where we were at, and they were a big German family and a very devout Catholic group bunch. And when I say a devout Catholic bunch, that's exactly what I mean. They were in church. In fact, my great-great-granddad, who homesteaded the place over by Urbana, from Germany, built this little rural parish, and we were in that church all the time. And I love those people. I have great memories of when I was a little boy running around barefoot on the earth, running around on the farm. I never felt separate from anything. I felt loved. I never felt any inadequacy about me with that stuff. When I was about 7 and a half, my great-grandpa John passed away, and this is the first experience I had with death. Up to this point, me and God were good. They taught us how to pray in that church, but as a little boy, still kind of connected to that faith that we come into this existence with, I never had any real reason to go to God with prayer. I did the up-and-down prayers at church and the supper prayers and stuff like that, but great-grandpa John passed away, and one of the things that the nuns taught us in that church is that God loves you and he answers all your prayers. And I knew that to be true, but I didn't really have any experience with utilizing it yet. But when great-grandpa John passed away, I saw a big German family that was usually happy and joyous and free, and, you know, they would they had a lot of fun, and there was always a lot of laughter and talking in the home, and And on that day, it was different. The air in the house was, it was scary almost. I saw this big family. They were really sad. And so, because God loves me and he would answer all my prayers, I went over and I went into this little bedroom of that farmhouse. And I knelt down next to a bed and I said the first sincere prayer of my life. And it was a prayer really from my soul. I meant it. And the prayer was, God, please bring great-grandpa John back to life. And as sure as I'm standing here tonight, I knew that that prayer would come to pass. I absolutely knew it. So, in fact, I thought I couldn't believe somebody else hadn't already thought of it. You know what I mean? And I went out and I sat on the couch and I waited for my great-grandpa John to walk in the door. And time went on. It was taking a long time. And I remember having some real innocent thoughts like maybe it's a long way from heaven and it's going to take him a while to get back. And so a couple days later, we're out putting great-grandpa John in the ground out at the cemetery. And I really love Bill Wilson's writing when he talks about how he began to look askance at these people around him. And that's exactly what I did as a little boy. 7.5 years old, that's when I started to feel a disconnect. I knew that for some reason that God didn't love me because he didn't answer that prayer. And I began to think that maybe I had done something wrong. And from that point on in my life, I just, as it talks about in our book, I just kind of discounted prayer. I discounted spiritual matters. I still went to church because I was a little kid and the folks made me, but I never really bought into any of it anymore. And so that's the attitude about spirituality and God. It was 20 years later when I was 12-stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous that I would even reawaken to the possibility that there's something that could help me, that was really here for me. And I started drinking really young. My dad had a bar in the basement on that farm, and we availed ourselves to it. But my first real run with alcohol came when I was about 12, and it was at a hog roast out in the country. And if you're alcoholic and you're sitting in this room, you would have loved this party. I guarantee it. There was some kegs lined around the garage, and a picnic table in the garage that was full of liquor bottles, everything you could imagine on top of it. And me and my buddy Mike started out the evening as beer runners. Essentially, we would fill pitchers of beer at the kegs and take them out to the people in the lawn chairs and the picnic tables and stuff. And they were always glad to see us. You know, they'd say, keep coming back, and we'd run to the keg and back. And at some point in the night, we ducked into the machine shed and started drinking. And I guess I came to alcohol that night with a little different experience, maybe an experience of needing to be changed somehow, because a change occurred in me that I never forgot. I didn't forget it to this day. And I'll tell you what, man, I drank an insane amount of keg beer that night. You know when you drink so much that I would go behind the chicken coop and throw up and go back and drink more. And I remember going into that garage and pouring some stuff in some cups and drinking a lot. And that's really the next whatever 16 years or whatever of my drinking. It was never different than that night. I blacked out that night. I passed out that night. I got thrown into the back of a car and drove home that night. I got carried into my parents' home that night and put to bed. I got that look that night that we get from people that love us. I clearly remember that and saw that a lot later on in my life, that look of disdain. And I woke up the next morning and I swore off alcohol. I was sick. I had a bad hangover, man. It felt like my tongue had turned into leather and I couldn't drink enough water, and I'd drink water and I'd vomit it. And it was a terrible hangover, and I swore off alcohol. And my high resolve lasted a few months. And that was my story. I humble beginnings. We got into junior high and started drinking a lot, and moving into high school, we had a state park that was built not far from this little town I grew up next to, and there was a farmer out there who opened a bait shop, and he would always sell us beer. So access to alcohol was never a problem for us ever. Frank would get up in the middle of the night and sell us a couple cases of beer or whatever we wanted. And I never seen that guy sell a worm. I don't think he sold bait, but he sold us alcohol and cigarettes and cigars and that kind of stuff. And we'd cruise around the gravel roads and drink and have fun. It was a lot of fun. God, it was fun. I got into my freshman year in high school, and I remember having these, like, the possibilities of youth. It's like I got my whole life ahead of me, and I started to think about things that I would like to do. And the high school I went to, my graduating class had 28 people in it, and that was with a foreign exchange student, right? We were small. And K through 12 was in one building, and I saw the senior guys walking up and down the hallways with the cheerleader under their arm, and I knew I could do that. They had a letter on their jacket with some medals on it for going out for sports, and that's what I wanted to do. And halfway through my freshman year in high school, I'm selling my dreams down the river. I have no idea I have alcoholism. I have absolutely no idea. I don't think I'd ever heard of alcoholism. But it was cutting me up at a real young age. And I got into my sophomore year, and we started a gang out there in rural Iowa. And you guys really have gangs here. I understand that. This wasn't really a gang. It was more like a drinking club. But we called ourselves the Odushi Brothers. And I have no idea what that means either, by the way, but that's what we called ourselves, and we had a hierarchy in the gang, and in order to move up in the gang, you just had to outdrink the guy ahead of you. We had a president, a vice president, he has presidential bodyguards, secretary, treasurer, and that kind of stuff, but I'm always proud to report in rooms like this that I was president of the Odushi Brothers. From its conception until I went off in the Navy a couple years later. And I used to think that was pretty macho because, man, them guys gave it a real whirl to try and outdrink me, and none of them ever could. I'd end up dropping them off at the end of their farm lane at whatever, 10, 30, 11 at night, and I'm going back to Frank's. I'm drinking behind this. What I learned much later was this physical allergy to alcohol that's outlined in the first 23 pages of our book, that once I put that stuff in my body, this physical allergy occurs. I'm wired different than a non-alcoholic, and it just condemns me to keep drinking. I start drinking alcohol, I get thirsty. And I don't know how more clearly to describe that. This will be the last thing of water I have tonight, I guarantee it. I probably won't even finish it, but if that was vodka, I have no idea where I'm ending up tonight. I have no idea, but I know that physical allergy will take me, and I'll drink insane amounts, and that doesn't go away no matter how long you've been around here. In fact, it's been my experience that it still progresses. That if I was to go out tonight and drink, I wouldn't pick up where I left off 23 years ago. It would be as if I never stopped. And that's pretty scary. Fear won't keep us sober, though, will it? So I went off into the United States Navy. I had bigger things to contribute to the planet than President of the Odushi Brothers. So I joined the Navy and had a pretty good time there for a while. I got stationed out in the Alameda, out in the Bay Area, and we used to go off base to a bar, and it was one of them bars where people didn't really get into your business. It wasn't preppy or anything. It was old people that drank, and nobody's really asking you what you do for a living and stuff. I like that kind of stuff. I'm not a I'm not a clubber. You know what I mean? I just want to drink. And that's where I met my wife, my first wife, Patricia, was in that bar. And there was a guy, I got to tell this story, because it shows you what I was like and the depths of my selfishness and self-centeredness and my lack of any real care and concern for any of God's kids. There was a guy on my ship from Tennessee. We called him Tennessee. And Tennessee was married, and I didn't know he was married. We're sitting at that bar one day. He never wore a ring or anything, and he said, "Yeah, I'm married, but it's kind of a secret. If you're married and in the service, it's like your paycheck doubles." Now, what do you think a young budding alcoholic starts to do with that? I equate that into more of everything, right? More money, more. And so I asked Tennessee, "Well, how did you do that? How did you find a girl to do that?" He said, "Well, I knew a friend back in Tennessee that I asked her to do it, and I send her $100 a month as part of the agreement, and when my 4 years is up, we'll just get a simple no-contest divorce, and then it's over. And in the meantime, I make out like a mad dog with double my paycheck." So I immediately start to think of some farm girl back in Iowa that would do that with me, and I don't come up with any at all. I knew they wouldn't. But I knew this girl, Patricia, that hung out at the bar with us a lot might be up for making an extra $100 a month. So my proposal to Patricia one Saturday afternoon, after very little sleep the night before, God, we were drunk. My proposal to her was, I said, "Hey, how would you like to make an extra $100 a month?" Right? And she, of course, said, "Yeah, what do I got to do?" So I laid it out to her, and we got on a bus to Reno, Nevada, and ended up at one of them little wedding chapels. And they're used to us, right? We showed up without a plan. And this guy went over and got in a little drawer and opened it up and fitted us with these plastic rings so we would have something to exchange. And he did his thing and blessed us. And he said, "You may kiss the bride." And I looked at him and said, "No, thanks." And yeah, it's true. I am not proud of that one. But that's what I was like. And Patricia's the only one left on my original 8-step list that I've not been able to find. I've just not been able to find her. And I hid behind a myth in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while with that I would hear in meetings, you know, that if God ever puts us together, I'll make that amend. Like it's God's job, right? It's not God's job. It's my job to take a spiritual action here on the physical plane that demonstrates my willingness to clean that up. And I eventually did that, and I did everything I know to try and find her. I hired a private investigator. I've done all the looking I know how to do, and we just simply can't find her. But after having taken that action, I can stand before you and say that if the universe ever conspires to put us together, that I do stand ready to make that right. And I hope I get to talk to her someday. I harmed that lady tremendously, and I hope she's okay. She could very possibly be a Jane Doe somewhere. But the Navy saw a young guy in a lot of trouble with alcohol, and they sent me to my first treatment center at the Naval Hospital in Long Beach, California, and that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. They took us to speaker meetings in Southern California 6 nights a week, and on the 7th night, the people out there had their H&I commitments. So they would come in and do panels for us and stuff, and on one night, they were talking about, I don't know, there's 4 or 5 up there, and they were talking about slogans, you know, like, "Let go and let God," and "Easy does it," and "Keep it simple," and all this stuff. And if you're new here, don't worry. I mean, that stuff, I understand that stuff today as a recovered alcoholic. I can let go and let God today. I'm properly armed with the tools in my life to be able to do that. But as a new person, how do you let go and let God? So don't worry about the slogans. Just work the steps, okay? But they're up there talking about that stuff, and then they started talking about one day at a time. And I got to tell you, I was sitting in the back of the room with my arms folded, and I've got the chatter of 100 monkeys going on in my head, and they're talking about one day at a time, and they said, if you can't do it a day at a time, do it an hour at a time. If you can't do it an hour at a time, do it a minute at a time. Anybody cannot drink, you know, for the next 60 seconds. You can pull that off. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I got to go the rest of my life 1 minute at a time, 1 hour at a time, 1 day at a time, day in and day out, week in and week out, feeling how I feel now, fighting to drink. And I knew back then that was a fight I was going to lose. But my hand went up because we could ask them questions, and I'm thinking about the rest of my life without drinking, and I'm not even able to comprehend it. But I said, hey, man, what about Super Bowl, right? I had never been to a sober Super Bowl party. And I threw out a couple other whatabouts, and I don't remember what they told me, but, you know, that's where I was at after my first treatment. And I ended up getting in a lot of trouble in the Navy. I got in some real trouble over in the Philippines and was placed on international legal hold for a while. I don't have time to get into that story, but the Navy ended up dealing with me very appropriately, and they did with me what they needed to do. And I got out of there and bounced around the country and ended up back in that little farming community. And in the interest of time, I'll just take you to my last drink. Now, I had, from the time I was in the Navy to my last run was about 7 years, 6 or 7 years. And I had been in and out of AA a little bit. I had never been in like a guy that would get 30 days and go back out. I'm talking about I'd come to a meeting and I'd be gone for a year. I'd come and get a court slip signed and I'd be gone for 6 months. I never had any time or anything here. But my last run started. I'm sitting in the back of a room above a bar in this little farming community, and I was doing a lot of stuff that night, and I got up off the floor, and I had a 12-pack. I drank everything and was in front of me to do, and went out to the refrigerator and opened it up. There was two beers left in there, and I felt like a cloak of darkness wrapped around me. I knew those two beers wasn't going to finish that run, and I didn't have any more means to get any more alcohol. And it was horrible. God, that was horrible. It talks about it beautifully in our book. You know, he'll be at the jumping off place. He'll wish for the end. He will know loneliness such as few do. It describes that moment wonderfully in a lot of ways. And it doesn't feel good, but it's a terribly good place to be, because that's what propels us into here. But that was the start of my last run, and that went on for about another year. And in that last year, I don't have very many memories. I have a couple. If I know I was going to be talking about an AA, I'd have paid closer attention for you guys. But I really don't have much memory of it. So on October 4th of 1992, I'm back in a meeting in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And what happened that night had not happened to me in all the previous years of being in and out of AA. And what happened is, after the meeting, a gentleman got up off of his seat, and he came over to me, and he stuck his hand out, and he introduced himself to me. And he said, would you like to go talk? And that's a real simple beginning of a very effective, what could be a very effective 12-step approach. And I didn't have anything else going that night, so I went with him, and he spent about 3 hours with me. And at the end of that meeting, I said, what do I do now? Because my experience shows me that I'm usually drinking after these meetings. I mean, I'm a guy that would go to 3 meetings a day not wanting to drink, and I'm drunk that night, wondering what in the heck's wrong with me. I'm a member of the baffled lot, you know. And he paused when I asked him that question. He said, well, Mike, when you get to where you're staying tonight, you should pray. And my last reference with that was the experience I had with my great-grandfather's death. And I recognized grace today in my life, and it was in my heart tonight, because all of those prejudices and preconceived ideas and notions that I had about God were somehow set aside. They weren't even a part of my consciousness. So there was no resistance to his instruction, but I did have to ask him, because it had been a long time, I knew that. I said, I'm willing to do that, but how do I pray and what do I pray for? And he said, it's real simple, Mike, just get on your knees and ask God for help. So I went back to where I was staying and knelt down next to that old torn up couch I'd been living on and said the prayer, God, please help me. And I meant that with my soul too. And he did. I stood up from that prayer a free man. And from that day to this, I've not always lived in the consciousness of the presence of God. That's an ideal in my life today. But I've not doubted the existence of a God from that day to this. I had an incredible experience with that that's beyond description. And so here I am now in AA, running around sober, going to a lot of meetings and trying to work steps. And it was, and getting active in amends. And I want to share a couple of those with you. I've been sponsoring guys since I was 2 months sober. And I'm glad I didn't have people around me telling me not to do that, or you got to wait till you're done with the 12 steps. Our history doesn't bear witness to that being, necessarily how you have to do that. But I got busy making amends, and in that little community I grew up in, I got to a point where I had made every amend that I was consciously aware of. Everybody on that 8-step list was done, right? The last 3 words of the 8-step are to them all. I was introduced to a program in this book that has that approach, to them all. If I harmed you, I owe you, period. And there are some exceptions to that, but there are few exceptions. In my experience, I've made amends to them all, except the ex-wife they told you about. And I was riding to meetings with a guy from this little community, and I still, when I would go to the store and stuff in that community, I felt kind of, I don't know, I just felt kind of different, like something wasn't quite done yet. So I asked this guy, Bill, I said, how do you make community amends? And he said, well, Mike, you just give back to your community. Bill was on the city council at the time. And he said, why don't you go down and put your name in the hat for city elections that are coming up? And I've always been obedient to my mentors, so I told him I would do that. But I absolutely knew that they would not elect me to anything in that community. I mean, I was arrested out of the bars off the main street, broke into the businesses. And but I went down to City Hall and Nancy was sitting there. I said, Nancy, I want to put my name in the hat for the upcoming elections. And she said, Mike, that's fantastic. What do you want to stand for, mayor or city council? Guess what I picked? Yeah, my people, I picked mayor, right? Now, I know I'm going to be able to go report to my mentor, Bill, that I took his instruction, but I stood for mayor, and I filled out the paperwork, and I forgot about it, quite frankly. I don't even vote, you know what I mean? And I do AA, and on the night of elections, I got home, and I had my own apartment by this time, and a TV, and a car with a muffler. You know what I mean? Things were looking up, and I get home and I'm watching when they have elections, they scroll the cities and the results on the bottom of the screen. I'm watching that, and it gets to this little town, and I'm watching it go by, and I had more votes than everybody, and I thought, that can't be right. So I waited for it to cycle all the way around again, and they elected me as mayor. And and I want you to know that has absolutely nothing to do with me. That has everything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. They saw a guy that had been profoundly changed. That's what they saw. I was quite shocked at that, though. I'm probably the only man in the history of elected politics that I honestly considered having him do a recount because I won. I couldn't believe it. But And they elected me to a second term after that. It was I got to give back. When I go back to that community now, it's all done. There's nothing left undone there. And I want to share one other quick men's story with you. I got to get down about out of time here. When I was home from leave on the Navy one time, I got a gal pregnant, and in a real mean way, I forced her into having that child aborted. And I'll finish this quickly. My wife, I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife got pregnant, and she's pregnant with twins, and we're doing those ultrasounds and seeing that life. What a spiritual experience that is to watch those guys grow up in there. But I started to have difficulty going to the ultrasounds. I couldn't understand what that was about, and more was revealed to us. And what was revealed to me is that experience. I was 13 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at the time, and that had went under the radar with all of my step work that I had done. It came to me then, and I contacted my sponsor and told him about it. And how do you make amends for that? I mean here I am claiming to live a spiritual life and in the world, and I felt like I had taken one. And so I sought some counsel and ended up doing I wrote a letter. Some people cannot be seen. We sent him an honest letter, and I had a two-page letter. I went out to our sacred place to me out on our farm, and I burnt some sage, and I read that letter, and I burnt the letter, and I let it go up. And then I stood up, and one of the things with amends is we always want to get to a point in there where we ask what we can do to make it right. And so I went to prayer with that, and I, God, if there's anything I can do to make this right, I'm your guy. I will go to any lengths to clean this one up with you. And as soon as I uttered those words, my phone started to vibrate. And I initially cursed myself because I had made a conscious decision to leave it in the car. In fact, I thought I had. And my phone was vibrating, so I answered it. It was a new guy I met at the fellowship club in Cedar Rapids a few days earlier. And he said, "Are you busy?" I said, "Yeah, I'm in the middle of something." And I said, "Are you okay?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I'll call you back in a few minutes." And I hung my phone up, and I went right back into that prayer. God, if there's anything I can do to make this right. I get that I'm a little slow. But as soon as I went back into that prayer, my cell phone went off again. That was a different new guy I had met that week at the fellowship club in Cedar Rapids. And I took that call. You know what I mean? This thing we call sponsorship has always been a very special thing to me. I've always held it in very high regard. God works through sponsors here. He absolutely does. So I've always looked at it as a very special thing. But from that day to this, it's been a very sacred activity in my life. I don't know how I could look at it any differently. Listen, thank you for my life today. I have a wonderful life. I'm a father of four children, beautiful wife, and have been rocketed into a way of living that I had no idea even existed. So thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for my life. I love you.